Canada. Can you tell us about beginningless time? As in the as in the jiva is reborn since beginningless time. Okay. See, there's no way really for the beginninglessness of the creation to be known by us. It's kind of like asking us to know what happened before time and space. But so we have to rely on with the Shruti, the vision of the Shruti, the vision of the Upanishads for that, for the Vedic vision. So what they say is that the creation is cyclical, means it comes into manifestation, sustained, and it goes into the unmanifest condition from beginningless time. Now what that means, beginninglessly, so what that means is that there is no first creation. There's always a prior creation infinitely back. That's what they mean by beginningless. It's actually beginningless and endless in terms of the nature of the creation itself. It's not true for the nature of the jiva gini moksha, that's different. But for the maya, as being kind of an intrinsic, incidental attribute, not bringing about any change to Brahman, but nevertheless being an attribute of Brahman. So Swamiji calls incidental attribute, because it itself doesn't have any being of its own, but there's no place else to put it. It has to belong to Brahman, because Brahman is non-dual and infinite. And so when did maya begin? Brahman is not going to create maya, because Brahman is free of time and free of parts. It doesn't have any hands or legs or sense organs or anything else, or a mind that says, let me create maya. There's no parts or no upadis, no conditioning adjuncts to become, for Brahman to become a creator. And so that means that non-dual Brahman is not beginningless, it is timeless, because no parts, no change. Right, so as Brahman is, Brahman is. If you, from the standpoint of the creation, if you go back, you know, billions and billions, multi-billion years, still as my being, the Satchit, the conscious being that I am right now, it is that way. Still exactly the same, because timeless, free of time. The creation has its being in Brahman, but the creation, there is no one to create it. Because the creation itself, going from unmanifest condition, when it comes into manifest condition, time and space comes into manifestation. So say the creation in its causal condition has no time, space, no experience of duality, no subject-object relationship, because it's in its causal conditions. What does that mean? All objectivity, time, space, etc., everything is in causal condition, means it's not experienced, it can't be experienced. Kind of like in the deep sleep state, where your mind in the deep sleep state is in causal condition. Right? The causal means it's still there, but it's unmanifest, causal or unmanifest, we can say. The mind is unmanifest, it's not non-existent, because the same mind wakes up. Right? But when it's in causal condition, it's not there to perceive or be perceived. Right? And so the universe is viewed in that way, as coming from unmanifest to manifest, unmanifest to manifest, from beginningless time. Beginningless time means there's no first time. You know, the universe came into manifestation, but then before that, it came into manifestation. So there's no first manifestation. So that's what I mean by that. As revealed in the Upanishads. Oh, and so how the jiva relates to that, again from the Upanishads, the Vedas, the number of jivas are infinite, which is interesting. Infinite, because infinite plus one is infinite, infinite minus one is infinite, right? So infinite number of jivas. When did the jivas begin? There is no beginning, there is no beginning for jiva is the individual. Each individual person has this reincarnating. When was your first incarnation? beginningless, just like the creation is beginningless. Beginningless karma, beginningless first karma incarnation. So that's kind of a mind-boggler to try to figure that out, how that is. But that is the vision of the Upanishads.
Yeah. I feel for throwing in a question as you speak on this. Vedanta was, how does people who relate themselves close to the Vedanta today think about the Big Bang? When you talk about the beginning.
People would say, oh, they're getting close. Science is getting very close to Vedanta in many, many ways. Yeah. Because when you think of the Big Bang, it's going into kind of a causal and manifest condition and then coming out and going back. So there's some similarity there. But there's a lot of difference too, because we look at Brahman, the conscious being, non-dual conscious being, as the very substance. There is no, really, in reality, there is no matter, there's only conscious being. And so this whole, when you think of it like that, when science thinks about the Big Bang, they still think of it, as far as I know, most of them anyway, think of it as inert. It's like it goes into its inert causal condition, comes out of its inert causal condition, or some don't, like Goswami or some others. You know, but what's similar is this movement, right? And that it'll expand like a rubber band, stretching and then slowly collapse back. And then the stress of that will make it go like that. So there's some similarity. Yeah. What else did I want to say about that? Or just another little thing to add on the everything that you say has implications, or everything that the Upanishad says has implications. One of the implications that I think is very important is that this being so from the vision of the Upanishads, that Brahman is non-dual, one without a second, and free of time, that means it is not creating anything, nor is it creating itself. So Brahman is what Brahman is. There's no creation of Brahman. It's kind of the bottom line. Being itself is what is. Okay. So Brahman didn't create itself. Brahman is. Maya, which has is an incidental attribute of Brahman, also is not created. Right? Because who's going to create it? You know, it is the very from causal, unmanifest condition to manifest condition, it is itself, contains all name and form, time and space itself. Also the manifestation of consciousness is the sattva in the Maya. So where would there be any room for a creator, because there's no second thing there? And Brahman has no hand, so Brahman's not going to create it. And we look at Maya as an incidental mitya attribute of Brahman. So what this means is, when you say, and we look at Brahman with the Maya Upadi, the conditioning adjunct of Maya, that's what we call Ishvara, God. So conscious being, which is the self in all beings, right, is Ishvara, we call it a jiva, when the upadi, conditioning adjunct, is this body-mind-sense organs, or any body-mind-sense organs that has a sukshma-sharira, subtle body, call that an upadi. Ishwara's upadi, what would make Ishwara Ishwara, is that the upadi is the whole maya, right? What we call the sameshti upadi, all of maya, the infinite knowledge. We call maya, then in that case, Swamiji will sometimes call it as infinite knowledge. And so that is the Ishvara Upadi, right? And it is beginningless, not created. So then when you ask, why did Bhagawan do it like this? Mm-hmm. Why didn't he make the creation a little differently so we could all have a little bit more shanti, a little bit more peace? Why does there have to be a dharma, you know? Why does there have to be cruelty? Why do people get themselves into such trouble? You know, why does the creation have volcanoes? All these things. Why? And there is, it's not that there's no answer to that. It's that the question is inappropriate. It's an inappropriate question because when something is uncreated and beginningless, then there is no, why did he do that? Because nobody has done anything. There just simply is what is. So it's like asking, who created God? Who is God's father? You know? And then, well, then, whose father was God's father? You know, that would go back also into an infinite regress. You know? Just like Maya goes back into an infinite regress. But here, with Maya, sattva, rajas, and tamas going into causal, manifest, there, the creation is the way it is. You know? And Brahman is the way Brahman is. So it's not a question of why is it this way, it's a question what way is it? And it's quite different. You say, why is it this way? You can be talking about that scientifically, how does this work, and how does this work, and how does this work? But why, in terms of giving some kind of a reason, this is why Bhagawan did this, then that's not appropriate. And an inappropriate question has no answer because the question is wrong. That question can't be asked for something which is non-dual and changeless, nor can it be asked for something that has no beginning. See what I mean? Because there is no creator. So when we call God the creator, that's in a way not quite right, because then we think of some God on some platform up in heaven creating the rest of the creation with his mind or with his hands or with his imagination and somehow doing an act of creation, you know. But how can that be possible when it's beginningless? So, and infinite. That's another, puts an end to the whole thing. Beginningless and infinite, you know. So all the possibilities are already there. So where's the creation then? It's just the way it is. What would you say is the meaning of life? Please elaborate on the expression resonates with my own being for pleasure boxing. Okay, so what is the beginning of life? Well, I always give the answer that Swamiji gave one time at the New Year's Eve celebration in Sailorsburg on the east coast at the ashram there. Swamiji, we'd actually be doing puja all day long on New Year's Eve and New Year's Day. New Year's Eve, we chant the Dakshinamurti Mula Mantra all the way into the Dakshinamurti Mantra, asking for Shri and for Tejas, you know, and for Jnanam and all this, Medha. So we chant it into the midnight hour, you know. And during that time, often Swamiji would give a talk. And then on New Year's Day also, he would give about an hour talk. So one, I think it was New Year's Day, actually. He gave a talk on what is the meaning of life, right? And he started by saying, everybody asks that question. What is the meaning of life, Swamiji? Yeah. And so he said, the meaning of life, the purpose of life, you know, is to live it. It's what it is. The purpose of life. The purpose of life is to live it. That's a very, very simple answer, really, you know. But what else is the purpose going to be? What is the purpose of being alive? Is to be alive. So the purpose of life is to live it. But then we can get into a little more detail around that. The purpose of life is to live it for the jnani. Because the jnani, the one who has self-knowledge, right, is just fine. I have this body, mind, sense organs. Let me live this life. Let me live the life that's been given to me. Let me appreciate the prarabdha karma, the karmas that brought me into this world and take me all the way through, which is really nothing but Ishvara. Let me live this life, you know. And enjoy Ishvara. and we can add a few things. But what should I do while I'm living my life? Well, do your dharma. You know, enjoy Ishwara, appreciate Ishwara. Do what the creation, moment by moment, asks of you in a dharmic way. This, you know, we often don't think of it like this, but actually, it's not that you're creating what is to be done. You're responding to, right, what is given. It's totally different. Actually, we are, if you look at it this way, we are always responding to the life that is given to us at moment by moment by moment by moment. And it changes everything. If you, instead of thinking, you know, I'm creating the situation, I'm responsible for the situation, it is much less of a burden to think that I am responding to the situation. The situation is Ishwara. And so if I want to respond to the situation in harmony with Ishwara, with God, then how do I respond? Well, the laws of Dharma, if I think of the laws of Dharma as being Ishwara's order, if I'm in line with Ishwara's order, then I am not creating any waves. It's very, very simple. If I'm out of step with Ishwara's order, I'm creating a rub, you know? And the rub creates dukkha. It creates some pain. But when I'm just responding to Ishwara's order, then I have shanti, and those around me have some shanti also. Especially when we think of Dharma, if you remember, what is at the top of the pyramid of Dharma? As we work our way down into more and more detail, at the top of the pyramid of Dharma is ahimsa, non-injury. So another way, let no being be afraid of me. And let me not be afraid of anybody. Let no being be afraid of me. If I'm not afraid of myself, if I'm not afraid of any being, I have no reason at all to hurt them or push them away. Even on a psychological level, on a personal level, in terms of this person can take something from me, this person can take something from me, this person might not be helpful to me. All of these type of fears about how a person may sabotage my well-being in one way or another. So if you think, what if I don't have any of that? What if I have no feeling that this is a violent person? You know? Let them be as they are. Therefore, you're fine the way you are. I have no problem at all, because I don't need anything from you. So let me not be afraid of anyone. You know? And let nobody be afraid of me, and they won't be afraid of me if I'm not afraid of them. Kind of a catch-22, but that's the sannyasa vow, really, of ahimsa. If you want to put that into practice, to really meditate on it, let me not be afraid of any being, and just think about what that means, that, oh, I'm afraid of the robber coming and stabbing you. Well, the chances of that are very, very slim. So let's practically think, what does it mean, let no being be afraid of me? Let me not be afraid of any being. And what would it mean in my relationship with you if I wasn't afraid of you? It means you're fine the way you are. You do not have to be different in order for me to accept you or to enjoy your presence or whatever. And when that's the case, then I become a safe person for you, right? Is just imagine what it's like when you're with somebody and they need you to be different. You know, you're not okay the way you are. If you really, you know, want to fit in and be with me, don't act like that. Don't be like that. Nobody feels comfortable in that, you know. When you're with somebody who's kind of critical of you, or, you know, why'd you do that? Or, I wish you wouldn't do that. You know. You feel fear, you don't want to be with that person. So that ahimsa, the abhayam means that freedom from fear vow. Then below that, as we, you know, try to define it a little bit more, do unto others as you would have done to yourself, don't do to others as you don't want done to yourself. And this is all kind of, you don't have to be taught, you can figure this out for yourself. It's innate, dharma is innate. And so really, when we're following this innate dharma, then there's a lot of shanti. Dharma protects. You know, so. So you can say again, like, the meaning of life or the purpose of life is to live it. But then what does that mean? You know, how to live it? All that. You know? For jnani, because you've discovered the source of ananda, the source of your being, there's no threat for you. And so you can just enjoy the life that you're living. You know? But until then, before that, you get an appreciation of Ishwara, appreciation of Dharma, and then you live the life in that way, in resonance with Bhagavan, and that gives meaning and purpose to your life, because you know that you're contained by something greater than yourself. That gives meaning to your life. You know? And the further away you go from that, the less meaning there is. Then it becomes, my new car gives me my new car, that I get this job has meaning, or that I have that I have my beautiful shining children have give me meaning, or, you know, it gets more and more fragile as you go down. So, in the end, for the jnani, the meaning of life is to live it. It's all Ishwara. I think you can answer that in different, interesting ways. Please elaborate on the expression resonates with my own being, for example, a pleasurable experience. Okay. When I was unfolding the nature of one's changing experiences of happiness and sorrow, sukha and dukkha, right? There's like a continuum of emotional life, from the negative to the most painful to the middling, and then to the most blissful. And so, say, on this continuum, here's the positive, here's the negative. And I used the word resonate or doesn't resonate. What we mean by when your mind, because of either dharma or positive experiences like taking a walk in nature, or the smile of a child that comes up and hugs you, or, you know, so many different things, listening to beautiful music, being with very good friends, your mind will take on a certain level of shanti. It's very variegated, the different types of shanti, peaceful mind, you know, peacefulness in your mind. It's variegated. There's many different subtle changes, but all of the subtle changes do not change the fact that the mind is very clear, clean, relaxed, kind of like a clear lake that's reflecting the sun is shining on it, the sun nicely reflected in it, even if the lake has some, you know, gentle waves. It's still beautiful. The sun is still beautiful. It's calm. It feels nice. The sun reflection feels good in that type of lake. Whereas if the lake is all muddy, you know, muddy and choppy, the reflection of the sun is not very visible, and it's agitated to boot, right? And so in this negative spectrum, there's more or less mud in the water, and there's more or less agitation in the water also, creating all of these different types of negative experiences, like, you know, dislike or anger or jealousy, or that type of greed or despair, you know, or depression or sorrow, sadness, these things that are actually causing pain to me. So now I use this word resonate, because in the positive spectrum, say if we use again the idea of the sun shining in the clear, relatively clear, calm lake with a lot of variability for all these different types of positive experiences like love, compassion, joy, bliss, etc. The sun that's in that water, right, is still being reflected in the water, so that the reflection is penetrating the water, right? Lighting up the water, penetrating the water, and the sunniness of the reflection resonates with the nature of the sun. But when we say resonate, it means it enjoys the same similar characteristics to the sun. You know, it is the same vibration as the sun in a way. It is not off-putting to the sun. It's like if the sun is shining on it and we're able to talk, it doesn't say, "What's that?" It feels like it itself is being reflected. See what I mean? That's what we mean by resonate, the word itself. Now say the sun is shining in this muddy, choppy lake, right? The sun doesn't see itself or feel itself in the lake. The lake doesn't reflect the sun, right? So it's not resonating with the sun. Right? So here, in reference to, first of all, I have to make a little correction in my analogy there. The sun's not thinking one way or another, but the fact of it, it's not thinking, oh, that water doesn't resonate with me. It's not thinking anything. It's just the sun, and it's perfect, right? But from the standpoint of the water isn't comfortable in reference to its being, because, say, it's the truth of itself is the sun, it's not reflecting the sun, or it is. If it's the positive, it's resonating with it, then its nature, what's reflected in its nature, resonates with the nature of the sun itself. Whereas in the muddy, it doesn't resonate because it can barely even find the sun. So those are the dark, dark feelings, right? So here, in reference to yourself, when the mind, because of fulfilling a desire, when it becomes desireless for that moment, right? If you fulfill a desire, so you're really working for something, you fulfill the desire, whoosh, you're like a Mahatma for the moment. Because at that moment, you've just fulfilled the desire, you don't want anything. And so your mind is just clear and smooth, at peace. You're like the clear, clear lake. And the sun of your being, right, is just manifest there without any sense of obstruction. So the mind feels at one with your being, with the truth of yourself. So those are all happy experiences. Well, I feel like myself. Whereas the negative spectrum, the mind doesn't feel like itself, like yourself. It feels like very uncomfortable, and that it has to get yourself back. Right? It feels alone. It feels isolated. It feels dark. It feels purposeless and meaninglessness. You know? That feels like it doesn't want to live, because its condition is so divorced, non-resonant from the one who's illumining it. So that's how we use this word resonate. Right? You have to understand what resonate means. It means that the nature of yourself, right, that there's something, the quality of the mind is in harmony with the nature of yourself, so that even though you don't know yourself, the nature of the mind is close to your own nature, and so you feel very happy. There's no conflict. But when the nature of the mind is very, say, muddy or dark or upset or agitated or depressed, that nature isn't close to yourself. And so from the standpoint to your own nature, and so that mind feels very alone, very isolated, or dark, depressed, all of these things. So that's how that word resonate is used. Paper hat. How does the cognitive understanding, viveka, that we are pure consciousness, bring us to stop suffering in daily life? What helps to speed up the emotional lag time between understanding it rationally and living it, feeling it? through the teaching methodology itself, kind of taking you step by step by step to the what we call viveka, the different, being able to differentiate your being, the me, from all of the experiences that are coming and going, so that your mind realizes that it is actually objectified. In fact, all experiences of the mind, whether they be perceptions or emotions or memories, all of them are objectified and actually completely free, or asanga. They're totally not affecting me, the subject. But for me to see that, for the mind has to see that, because it's the mind that's suffering from the ignorance. Your mind is taking your being to belong to it. And taking your being to belong to it, it's then searching the world for situations and things to gain and get rid of so that I can feel happy. Like, if only I could have this, why we work to fulfill desires, if only I could have that, I would be happy. And so then I get that, and the mind becomes calm. See, desires are, they work, right? When you have a desire, you fulfill the desire. For that moment, you're desireless, and the mind becomes silent, quiet, doesn't want anything. Even though, I mean, I'm jokingly, tongue-in-cheek, seriously saying, even though jokingly and tongue-in-cheek, I seriously mean that those moments of silence when you fulfill a desire don't last very long. Sometimes they only last 15, 20 seconds before the next thought comes, you know, and says, yeah, but I could lose that if this or that happens. Or, you know, I need this too. You know, so fast it comes. It's really shocking and disappointing. It comes so quickly. Okay, but it's those moments when that viveka is there, that discrimination is there, and you understand how this illusion is taking place. You understand the mechanics of it. I want something, I feel stressed, I'm working and working to get it, I have enemies, all the people that aren't helping me to get it, I have friends, all the people that are helping me to get what I want. All these likes and dislikes and friends and enemies, all of these things are created by my desire to have this object which I believe will make me happy. But actually, it's not making me happy at all. What it's giving is that the moment that I get it, it's giving me a shantavritti, a peaceful thought. And in that peaceful thought, it's like the sun shining in the clear lake. I feel totally great. And I'm so happy, and then I become very possessive of the object, because the object is what made me feel that way. That's the illusion. But as I start to see through this illusion, then my mind gains vairagya. That viveka, seen through the illusion, is viveka, discrimination. My mind gains vairagya, and it starts more and more seeing, you know, it is not these objects that are making me happy or sad. What makes me happy is the shantavritti from the standpoint of the mind. But the shantavritti, the vritti, the thought modification itself is inert. It's an object. So it's not really making me happy. What's making me happy is my own nature. My own nature is the ananda. And then when there's a shantavritti, a peaceful thought there, my being is reflected as though in that shantavritti, and then I say, I'm so happy. You know? But for jnani, we don't want to gain our shantavrittis, these peaceful thoughts, by fulfilling desires. Because it's silly. It's very circuitous. It's a circuitous route. Here, look at how simple it should be, right? If we have knowledge, of course. I am, my being is the ananda. It is the source of any wholeness or any fullness that's ever experienced. It's only the wholeness of my being. That's it. All of these objects have nothing. That's why sometimes they make you happy, sometimes they make you sad, sometimes you don't care about them. They have nothing, really. They're just, because of the delusion, because I think they will make me happy, they have the power to give me a shantavritti when I fulfill the desire. Right? Because at that moment I have what I wanted. And so now I'm at peace. It only lasts for a few minutes, but now I'm at peace. And so now that the sun of myself is shining brightly in that mind, because that mind is so clear. That's the reality of it. And as the more I start to understand this, the less I am asking the world to make me happy. I'm more and more and more, as I mature in my knowledge, I become happily, I live in the world, rather than I look for the world to make me happy. So my mind enjoying going to the source of the ananda, which is, you know, like the clay pot, has no distance between me and my mind for the very source of ananda. Abiding in my own ananda, I experience the world really as Ishwara. I say really as Ishwara because I'm not really asking anything of it. As soon as you ask something of it, you're a jiva. I need this and I need that to be happy, and you know, all of that. That jivatvam comes, that individuality comes, that I need this to be happy. But when I'm enjoying the ananda, which is myself, and then I'm in the world, then it's very easy for me to just do what the world is asking, what Bhagavan is asking me of me in this moment, because I'm not asking the world to be responsible for my happiness, because it isn't. It isn't responsible, and I know that. And because I know that, I slowly but surely, because of the emotional lag time, I slowly but surely stop asking. You know? That because it's a nuisance. Why am I going to ask for something that it can't give it to me anyway? Why am I going through all of this? It's not worth it. So if my mind wants to ask for something, if it's not very serious about it, I don't mind. But if it's serious about it, I'll say, let's not go there. Because it's a circuitous route that's filled with peril. Because this thing that you're after is away from you, you know. And there's no guarantee whatsoever that you can get this thing. And if you do get it, there's no guarantee at all that it will make you happy, because by the time you get it, you may not even want it, because you change also. And if you do get it, somebody else can take it away, you know, or maybe it doesn't want to come with you. It's so much energy to acquire something that doesn't have the ananda that you're seeking for in the first place. And so you have clarity and knowledge of this, much experience of it, and so, slowly but surely, your mind lets go. It's called vairagya. It takes place over time. And yes, there is an emotional lag time. That slowly, it's kind of like a flower unfolding. And so the best way that we've found to kind of help the flower, give it the water and the sun and the you know, the soil that it needs, is that karma yoga buddhi. The karma yoga, basically, just to quickly, and maybe in a class I'll go over much, much more detail. Karma yoga is meant for a mumukshu, one who really is desirous of liberation and is being exposed to this teaching. Karma yoga isn't just for a dharmanishta or a good person or something like that. Karma yoga is really a sadhana for the mumukshu who is gaining this knowledge. And basically, the karma yoga buddhi, even though this kartritvam's doership is still there, you know, I am a doer and I want to fulfill my desires and all that, that is still there. Still, what I practice is, if I have desires that are within Dharma, then I work to fulfill those desires, but accepting the results of my actions with that prasada buddhi. Get a puja at the end, and they give you some water, or some sandalwood, or some rose petals, or a laddu, or whole meal, whatever they give you, from a whole meal to just some water, you accept it with gratitude and love, and as prasad from Ishwara. So you do what you do, you're responsible for your actions, you keep them within Dharma, and accept the results as prasad from the Lord. That starts giving you much more naturally a shantavritti. You know, your mind is at peace because you're not getting all upset. You know, because everything that comes your way is from Ishwara. And then on another level, when you're not kind of plagued by desires that you feel driven to fulfill, then every moment, you know, that you are here alive, you know, in your prarabdha karma, the karmas that have brought you here, then you do what Bhagavan asks of you to do in every given situation. And what Bhagavan asks of you is presented to you by the situation, and what is your dharma in the situation. It's not what are your likes or dislikes. That becomes really irrelevant. What is being asked of me? You know, and that's what I do. And that's my commitment. That's my sadhana, to do what is asked of me. And we don't even think that much about likes and dislikes, and initially maybe. But once you know that really the likes and dislikes are just a delusion, as though this or this or this or this is the source of your happiness, that's just simply not true. The source of your happiness is your own being. And so your mind, being with yourself, fulfilled by your own, the ananda of your own being, experiences the world. And, you know, with that, then you might think, well, how can I really relate to people then? What Swamiji would say, or what I would say is, then you can really relate to people. Then you're free to really be with them, because you're interested in them and who they are. You know, it's not so much be this way so that I can be happy. You know, you can be so connected, so completely connected, because your own well-being is not at stake, because they really can't hurt you. You know, there might be stings and stuff, but nothing can. I mean, somebody can say mean things and hurt your feelings and all of that, but not really. Not that those things, they're like riding on water. These little pinpricks and whatnot, they're like riding on water, because they never touch yourself. So the pinprick takes place on top of the wholeness of yourself. And so, but you have to give your mind time, you know, to grow up, to mature in light of your knowledge. You know, be patient that way. And it will mature because of your knowledge. Knowledge means you understand, you know, you experience. You recognize the truth of what's being said. You recognize the truth of your own being. It's been differentiated. And the teaching, it makes it clear to you from so many different ways. It's not just one logic or two logics. It just goes on and on and on, endlessly unfolding, so that you see and you see and you see again and you see again. Makes all these connections, and then your mind starts making its own connections, and you get getting more and more clarity. But it's not like a shakti pot, you know. It takes its own time for that clarity to mature. For the clarity to come, and for the mind to take the time it needs to own it. So that's why we have this emotional lifetime phrase. Karma yoga helps to speed it up. Another thing, along with the karma yoga, which I guess I consider as part of the karma yoga, but it's worthy of saying it separately, is that being a friend to yourself. That being a friend. You know, when I talk in the meditations, we do that inner friend, where you create the witness, the sakshi, you know, the one who is commenting on yourself or on your mind, your thoughts, your feelings, your decisions, the things that happen to you. The commentator, the running commentator, is on your side, is really a good friend who gives you the benefit of the doubt, who cares about you, who knows you're a good person, who knows you're doing the best that you can, who respects you. One thing, really wonderful exercise to do, is just like tonight and tomorrow, just watch how you talk to yourself. If the way you talk to yourself or are present to yourself and to your thoughts and to your, you know, foolishness and all of that stupid things you say and all this kind of stuff. Say you say something really stupid and embarrassing. or whatever. That can happen when you're a teacher. That doesn't happen to me very much anymore because I don't care. But say you do something, you know, that's embarrassing to you or something, and your mind, the buddhi or the witness goes, you are so stupid. How could you say something like that? Oh my God. So my father used to talk. Yeah. But if you were to say something like that, and then inside you just feel so awful. But what if the voice inside said, that was funny, don't worry about it. You know, it doesn't matter, it's fine. You know, nobody's going to care. You know? I thought it was cute. Whatever. But what I'm saying is that the attitude is much, much different. The attitude of somebody on your side who cares about you and wants to help, you know. So listen to yourself and see, you know. See if you provide an inner space, a home for yourself. You know, like the, say if you have a what you would consider a really beautiful community, a really good home. You know, that's because you feel loved and cared for everybody in your by your community or by your family, and you feel that way toward them, then you feel so at home. You feel so relaxed. You feel so happy to be there. You know. So you have to have that internally. That you have that inner support system of the people and attitudes that really support you and love you and are on your side. And the best way and you can get it quite easily. The problem is that from infancy, really, we are raised with our parents and our family constellation who are how they are. And you could have very critical parents, and their parents may have also been very critical, you know, very worried, very kind of angry, quickly irritated, you know, and they probably had that from their parents. And so then you're ingesting, we call it as an introject, the way that they are, the way they talk to you. The little child starts talking to herself or himself that way. Like if the father or mother is always critical and saying, you're such a stupid idiot. Some parents talk to their children like that. You're such a fool. You're such an idiot. You're never going to amount to anything. Then the little child, I'm so stupid. I'm such an idiot. I'm never going to amount to anything. Then when they do make some mistake, you're so stupid. You're never going to amount to anything. Because they've interjected that voice. And since the parents have it from before you were born, that's your environment. That's the environment you grow up with. It could be very positive also. It just depends, or it could be a mix. But just know that that is the environment that the little child introjects, means swallows whole, takes it in. And then their little mind is talking to themselves that way all of the time, you know. And because you take it in at such a very, very young age, you don't even hear it. It's just how, you don't even notice it. You may hear it inside, going on inside, but you don't really notice it as being anything odd or anything, you know. So now if I ask you to listen, then you might be a little surprised. And then you can say, ah, we don't need to talk to ourselves that way. Let's try something different. And then just change it. Just change it. Somebody that, say you have a mean, kind of a gruff parent or something that says, always saying, you're so stupid, you never amount to anything. And here you are at 40 years old, you're so stupid, you never amount to anything. Doesn't matter what age, you could be 80, honestly, if you never caught this. So then what you need to do, when you hear that, say, no, it's not true. You're not stupid. Actually, you're a very beautiful person. You know, I think you're great. And you would be shocked that all the little ones inside are going to go, ah, really? And everything starts to loosen up and everybody becomes happy. You know, they realize there's somebody inside that cares about me. You know? It's really a beautiful thing. It's definitely worth listening. And maybe for you, you have a few things that are said that are mean or something like that. You can change it. And even if, now, even if it's relatively neutral, you can become positive. Because going from neutral to positive is huge, you know? Because all of a sudden there's warmth inside. It makes a very, very big difference, you know? There's somebody inside who cares. Instead of being like space or just being neutral, there's a caring presence inside. Then inside, outside, you have that caring presence. That, even in my patients, my clients, when they tell me, like when their therapy is over and they're ready to leave, and we do kind of, we spend, you know, I don't know, a month or two kind of just going over the therapy and what was important, that the changes were made. This is the number one important. The number one for almost every single one. Even the students at school, this is the number one. Because all of a sudden they have a beautiful home. And it's not that hard, so. All right, we'll do these tomorrow. Okay. Getting tired? Yeah. Let me see if it's hard. I'll do it. If this isn't hard, I'll do it. I'll say. No, I'm tired. It's a good question, and then it would take me too long to answer it. Yeah. I can't.
There's another question.
Okay. Let me see. Let me see here. No, it's not the questions, it's me. I'm done. My mind is stopped. Quarter past nine. Oh! Yes! I always run out of gas at quarter past nine. Invariably, I'm trained. Yeah. And then they'll always do exactly what Sky did. There's one more. And then we'll try. Say, okay, let's try. No, sorry. Can't do it. It's over. That's how it is. Okay.
<You're sorry.
laughs> Yeah, I just run out of gas. So.
Swasti prajabhyah paripalayantam nyayena margena mahim mahishaha go brahmanebhyah shubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini Desho yam kshobharahitah Brahmana santu nirbhayah Om sarvesham swastir bhavatu Sarvesham shantir bhavatu Sarvesham purnam bhavatu Sarvesham mangalam bhavatu Sarve bhavantu sukhinah, sarve santu niramayah, sarve bhadrani pasyantu, ma kaschit dukha bhavet, asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma amritangamaya, Om Purnam idam purnat purnamudachyate purnasya purnamadaya purnameva vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om